Thank you, Aaron. Appreciate that very much. I'd like you to take your Bibles, please, or the one in the pew rack in front of you, to 1 Kings chapter 18, the Old Testament book, 1 Kings chapter 18. As you know, people serve the Lord in various ways. And sometimes God's servants can be found in the most unusual places, sometimes surprising places. Now, in 1 Kings, we run into the prophet Elijah. He's not the main focus of our study today, but he is a major player in it. But Elijah served as prophet to Israel in a very, very dark time in their history. King Ahab and his lovely wife Jezebel were in charge of the kingdom at that time. They were worshipers of the pagan god Baal, which actually involved a whole array of pagan gods. But it was a violent and deplorable religion that included everything from temple prostitution to child sacrifice. And the prophet Elijah appears on the scene, actually in chapter 17 at verse 1. And he's sent there by God to confront Ahab and Jezebel about the sin of the nation, but also to announce to them that God is going to hold back rain and dew on the land until Elijah comes with a word to start it back up again. It would actually be the word of God through Elijah, and he speaks on behalf of God. Now, any knucklehead knows that when you're faced with a confrontation like that, it isn't going to turn out well. And that probably explains why, after making that announcement, God immediately whisked Elijah away for 3 years for his own protection. But the prophecy came true. After that announcement was made, every day the weather in Israel was the same. Clear skies, plenty of sunshine, stifling heat, no rain in sight. So God sent Elijah to the land of Gilead, which is east of Jordan, outside of Israel. For a while, Elijah drank from a little brook, and he was fed by ravens. You remember that story. When the brook dried up, God sent him to a little village called Zarephath, where he was provided for by a widow and her son. And this, again, was outside of Israel, right in the heart of Baal worship. A strange place for God to send his servant. It was actually the very place where Jezebel was from, her hometown. So I imagine God sent the prophet there to that strange place for his protection, knowing that that's the last place that Ahab would be looking for Elijah. But all this time, while Elijah is in hiding, Ahab is scouring the nation looking for Elijah. But as the days pass, the fields turned brown, the ground became dry and cracked, crops died, cattle became emaciated and started dying off. And that would include Ahab's own horses, which he desperately needed for his army. That was the strength of his forces, were the horses. I didn't mean to rhyme that, it just came out that way. But the grain storehouses, they became emptied and people were starving. And so Ahab is certainly so determined to find Elijah to get this thing over with that he even sent his own soldiers out to scour the land, even the surrounding nations, to try to find Elijah. He just never thought to look at Zarephath, God's plan. Well, then finally, after 3 years of waiting, the word of the Lord came to Elijah again, and that's where we pick it up at verse 1 of chapter 18. Now, it happened after many days that the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year, saying, "Go show yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain on the face of the earth." So Elijah went to show himself to Ahab. Now, I wonder how Elijah felt about that. I'm sure that on one hand, he understood the danger, because Ahab is going to be extremely unhappy about the conditions. But on the other hand, I'm sure that Elijah was himself glad to get this famine over with, because it was affecting him, but he knew what it was doing to his people. And during those years of hiding, he must have wondered why God was keeping him idle for so long. Here he is, a prophet of God, he's a preacher, but God's not using him. And here he sits doing nothing while wickedness is spreading throughout God's own people. And maybe he prayed once in a while, God, why don't you do something? Why are you leaving me here? Well, to his credit, Elijah patiently waited until God gave him the green light to go back. So he traveled from Zarephath into Samaria, and this is where he runs into a man named Obadiah. He's the real focus of our message today. It's not Obadiah, the prophet who wrote the book that bears his name. This is a different guy with the same name. But Elijah and Obadiah both have something in common. They're both servants of God, and both serving him in different ways and in different places. So we want to learn just a few lessons. I have three lessons I just want to give you that we can learn from this experience of Obadiah in particular, but also how Elijah fits into it. But the first lesson, the first point, kind of ties in with the title here, that God often plants his servants in dark places. Unusual places, strange places, but sometimes they're very dark places spiritually. So this is where we're introduced to Obadiah. We pick it up the end of verse 2. Now the famine was severe in Samaria. Ahab called Obadiah, who was over the household. Now Obadiah feared the Lord greatly, for when Jezebel destroyed the prophets of the Lord, Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them by 50s in a cave and provided them with bread and water. Then Ahab said to Obadiah, go through the land to all the springs of water, to all the valleys. Perhaps we will find grass and keep the horses and mules alive and not have to kill some of the cattle. So they divided the land between them to survey it. Ahab went one way by himself and Obadiah went another way by himself. Now Obadiah, you're going to find, is a rather intriguing person, I think. For one thing, we're told here that he was Ahab's chief of staff. We'll call him that. We might be able to relate to that title. But he was literally in charge of Obadiah's household, which meant he kept things running smoothly. He probably oversaw the servants and the waiters and kept the king's appointment book and scheduling. But at the same time, we're told that Obadiah was a devout believer in God, in verse 3. And later in the story, he's going to tell Elijah, that is, that he had worshipped the Lord since his youth. So you have to wonder, maybe, how such a godly man could end up in charge of the palace of a wicked couple like Ahab and Jezebel. And not only how he managed to get into that position, but how could he stay there? In fact, there are some reliable commentators that believe that Obadiah serves as an example of spiritual compromise and deluded faith. He shouldn't have been in that place as a godly man. In fact, if he was truly a man of God, he'd leave there. But I don't think we should be too quick to condemn Obadiah. You know, God often does place his servants in strange and dark places. Take, for example, Joseph. At the right hand of the Pharaoh of Egypt, not an easy place for a believer in God to be. But yet God used Joseph in that position, you know, to supply food to his own people during famine. And we can't overlook Esther. Right there, in the court of the king of Persia, but through her own people were spared from a Holocaust. God used her in that tremendous way. And you know, of course, the words of Mordecai. Perhaps God has placed you here for such a time as this. Or how about Daniel, placed in the court of King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon? How fun was that? Well, we know all about Daniel's adventures. It wasn't easy, but yet God used Daniel to introduce Nebuchadnezzar to the living God. And then as you move into the New Testament, we meet a woman named Joanna in Luke 8, verse 3. She's a godly woman, but she is King Herod's household manager. Imagine that. And Joanna was one of the women who went to the tomb of Jesus on that resurrection morning. Imagine working in Herod's palace, the very place where John the Baptist was beheaded. But she was there. In his letter to the Philippians, Paul sends greetings to those believers in Philippi from those who are of the household of Caesar. Philippians 4:22. You mean there are Christian people in the household of Caesar? Right there at the highest level of the Roman Empire? Yeah. How did they get there? Well, how did any of these people get into that, the positions they were in? Now, perhaps like those in Caesar's household, some of them may have become believers after they were already working there, and through the ministry of Paul, they became fellow Christians. But others, like Joseph, Esther, and Daniel, they were already God's people before they got into those places. So I would suggest to you that God places people in weird and dark places by His own sovereignty. And these people we looked at were gifted people, trustworthy people, who somehow in the midst of their dark working environments remained godly. But yet at the same time, they were common people like you and I. Just ordinary people, but surrender to God. And so you can see that Obadiah wasn't the first devout believer in God in a dark place. So we could make this little comparison between Elijah and Obadiah and say that Elijah was one who was called to overtly confront evil from the outside, that is, outside of the palace. Whereas Obadiah was called to covertly work to overcome it from the inside. See, God has His agents in different ways and places, doesn't He? And yet, at the same time, though, Obadiah's calling, I think, placed him in a position of tension. Anybody in a position like that is going to be in a place of tension. Here's a man who had to obey Ahab, the king, but he also had to obey the Lord. And at times, I'm sure he must have wondered if he was where he was supposed to be. When those two ways of obedience collide, how do we manage that tension? Well, my answer to that question is there is no easy answer. How's that for wiggling out of that one? But you see, as long as we're in this world, we have to associate with evil in some way. But I would hasten to add that there's a big difference between direct and indirect association with evil. We should always avoid direct association with sin and evil. Do our best to stay clear. But we can't always avoid the indirect connection because we're in this world that is one giant arena of corruption and sin, and we're these little islands who are placed in the midst of all of that. For example, you might work in a company that, among other good things that this company makes or sells, also manufactures and sells a product that is used for immoral purposes, or people use it for immoral ways. And you can't really help that. You can't control always what your company is going to produce. Now, how do you manage that tension, though? Well, that's where it gets tricky. And that's, I think, where we just have to use some spirit-guided wisdom and follow the convictions of our heart, but we can't always avoid the indirect association with those things because we live in this fallen world with fallen people. Now, you know, if you're called upon to work on the line that to manufacture this, or your company calls you as a technician to develop a product that is going to be something you know is detestable to God, yeah, then you might want to draw the line there. Daniel did that, didn't he? He knew where to draw the line. So did Joseph. But the thing about Obadiah is he did make a difference. His career as Ahab's chief of staff really does serve as huge significance to every follower of Christ who struggles with that tension. And like Joseph and Esther and Daniel and the others, he shows us that God places his servants in surprising places, dark places, to make a difference for him, to be an influence in some way. So wherever you are, you're not there by accident. And God can use you in some way as his representative in that place. But we do have to be wise about it. And I think maybe this is why Jesus said in Matthew 10:16 to his disciples, "I'm sending you out as sheep among wolves." But then he added, "Be as shrewd as serpents, but harmless as doves." Be shrewd, be discerning. But don't be a pain in the neck because of your faith. Now, Obadiah's defining moment, I think, came when he was willing to risk his life for the Lord. Jezebel began killing off the prophets. And Obadiah rounded up those 100 prophets and hid them in a cave and fed them with bread and water, which was scarce at the time. And this shows us, I think, that Obadiah wasn't a believer in name only. And he knew that if Jezebel found out what he was doing, she would lose her mind and he would lose his head, literally. It would be that bad. But he was willing to risk it all if it was God's will. Most of you are familiar with Corrie Ten Boom and her story of survival in the Holocaust and great books that she's written and just some tremendous statements she made that are repeated. One of the things that Corrie Ten Boom said was, "God doesn't have problems, only plans." Sometimes we have to bring that to our minds when we're faced with a crisis in our lives, or in the times when we're just wondering what God is doing or why he isn't doing anything, and we're kind of sitting idly. Just remember, God doesn't have problems. He only has plans. And God had a plan when he placed Obadiah in that dark place with Ahab and Jezebel, and his calling to work undercover for God in the midst of wolves allowed him to make a difference. If he was a prophet like Elijah, he could not have done what he did to spare those prophets. So when you consider what he accomplished through that, we could say that Obadiah was a good man in a bad place who did the right thing when it mattered the most. A good man in a bad place who did the right thing when it mattered most. And there are times when we have to be willing to simply trust God and take a risk. And when those opportunities present themselves, I think God will give us the wisdom to discern that this is something that he has placed in front of us for his purpose. Now there's a second lesson here that we'll just touch on briefly. Avoid judging other Christians over their place of service. So Ahab sends Obadiah on a mission to find grass for their cattle. While Obadiah is out searching for grass, he runs into Elijah. A coincidence? I don't think so. I think it was a divine appointment. But when you read this encounter, there's just a little hint, I think, that there's a bit of tension between Elijah and Obadiah. Not anything really strong, but Elijah needs Obadiah to go back and arrange a meeting with Ahab. Now, he thinks Obadiah is Ahab's servant, but Obadiah plays along with it, you know. In fact, he called himself Elijah's servant. So go back and arrange a meeting with your master. But it seems rather clear that there's apprehension on the part of Obadiah to go through with that. And Ahab might have been, or I should say Obadiah might have been thinking, you know, Ahab has a warrant out for this guy. And he's been on the lam for 3 years now. And what's going to happen if I go back and tell Ahab I have found him, but I didn't bring him back in handcuffs? Certainly, he's going to kill me because this guy has a habit of disappearing. And suppose he disappears after I leave and we can't find him. You think Ahab's going to think kindly of me? So there is some legitimate concern, I think, on the part of Obadiah. Now, whether Elijah understood that, I'm not sure, but we do know that Elijah reassured him in verse 15, "As the Lord of hosts lives before whom I stand, I will surely show myself to him today." So Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah. So it all worked out. But again, there are some commentators who have criticized Obadiah for being afraid. Why would you be afraid? You're a man of God, do it. Well, he's already shown his bravery by being willing to hide those prophets and being willing even to die if he got caught. So my thinking is, his apprehension is maybe, yeah, if Elijah doesn't show up, then it's curtains for me. But I think he probably doesn't want to die for something as stupid as setting up an appointment. Maybe that's it. You know, I'll be a martyr, you know. I'll die if I'm doing the work here, but just a scheduling thing and a guy doesn't show up and I get whacked for it? No. So Elijah, on the other hand, is this bold prophet who speaks for God and he doesn't back down to anyone and he can't understand why anybody else would and why he'd be afraid. But let's bring it into our camp here, in our experience. Do you ever get a little critical or judgmental of the way someone else is serving the Lord? You got to think about that because it comes so subtle to us that we're doing it the right way and they're not. That's tricky. But I wonder sometimes if our proneness to judge other believers for the way they are serving the Lord might stem not so much from spiritual insight as from a failure to recognize our differences in personality, our differences in calling, just the different ways that God uses us. We're not all the same. And God can use us in different environments to reach different people. And I'm thankful for that. There are churches near us that aren't like us. But as long as they're preaching the gospel, they're reaching people that we can't. And I have to just surrender that in humility before the Lord and say, God, if you bless them in that way, then who am I to sit back and cry and grumble and moan? You've given me enough responsibility, and I just want to be faithful to what you've given me to do. That's enough. Well, bottom line is God uses different types of people in different callings. And I think when it comes to being a bit critical or over-evaluating someone else's ministry, we need to remember what the Apostle Paul said in Romans 14, verse 4. Who are you to judge the servant of another? To his own master he stands or falls, and he will stand, for the Lord is able to make him stand. So I'm not accountable for what anybody else does. I'm only accountable to God for what I do and what he gives me to do. Well, one more point. Serving God in a hard place forces us to make hard decisions. That happens sometimes. And I'd guess that most of us, most of you, have callings more like Obadiah than like Elijah. Not all of you are going to be called to serve in Christian ministry as a career or to work for Christian organizations or be missionaries somewhere. Most of you are probably working in a place where things go on that you're not especially comfortable with. And sometimes it puts you in a position where you have to make a difficult choice. And there's probably teachers out there in public schools who might be wondering, how can I support a school system when I can't even mention God or Jesus in my classroom? Or how can I teach this curriculum that contradicts my own convictions? Or a Christian lawyer. That's not an oxymoron either. There are some. He might be wondering, how can I in good conscience uphold or defend a law that I think is wrong? Or a Christian doctor may wonder, how can I serve in a hospital where there are procedures that go on that I know God detests? Or a Christian politician might wonder, how can I be part of this administration that I feel is making compromises, doing things that I don't like or don't agree with? The list could go on, and these are good questions and that lead to hard decisions that sometimes have to be made. You may be even wondering right now, as a disciple of Jesus Christ, should I even be in the job I'm in? Maybe I should teach in a Christian school. Maybe I should find a Christian company to work for. Well, again, sometimes you just have to follow your convictions on those things. And I can't dictate what any one person should do or not do unless you're called upon to violate a command of God. If you're commanded to do something that is sinful, yeah, you got to draw the line. But if you're trying to serve God in a dark place and juggle your commitment to Him, as well as your commitment and obligation to your superiors, here are two things just to bear in mind, two things that Jesus said that help keep things in perspective. Number one, He said, no one can serve two masters, Matthew 6:24. So you have to determine right from the start that I have only one master. I can't have two. Jesus Christ is my Lord, my Savior, my Master, and I won't disobey a clear command from Him no matter what it costs me. So that's where we start. But the second thing Jesus said that helps kind of balance things out in Matthew 22:21, remember to render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's. So we've got to strike that balance. So we have one master, but we also have the responsibility to our employer and what they tell us to do. If your employer comes along and tells you, and he knows you're a Christian, and says, I don't want you sharing your faith on the job. I don't want you doing that. I had that happen to me. He said, I don't want you, he called it proselytizing. I don't want you proselytizing on the job. And I didn't. I obeyed that command because that's what's expected of me. And I wasn't disobeying the Lord in any way doing that. But there are other times when we have to draw the line. But we also have to obey the laws of the land, whether we agree with all of them or not, unless we're commanded again to sin or to do something that is against the will of God, or the law of God particularly. But as God's servants, we still need to live out our lives in an evil world and make those hard decisions between right and wrong. Now, I want to read you an illustration of that. This is written by Mark Mitchell, who is a pastor of Central Peninsula Church in Foster City, California. He shares this experience he had. He said, when I was in seminary, I worked as a waiter. It wasn't the greatest job in the world, but it helped support my wife and daughter. There were a lot of things that went on in the restaurant I worked in that were wrong and hard to be around. I served alcohol to those who drank too much. I served food to those who ate too much. I helped create a romantic atmosphere for couples that had no business being together. But I pretty much kept my mouth shut and did my job. I suppose there are some followers of Christ who'd never work at a place like that and would judge someone like me who did. But I needed the job and tried to make a difference. One day, my boss came to me and told me to stop claiming all my tips as income, because if my reported tips were always much more than the others, the IRS would catch on that they were lying. I was putting them in jeopardy of being busted. I told him I could not lie, and if I had to lie to keep my job, he'd have to find another waiter. He didn't like that, but he knew I was a hard worker, and he never brought it up again. So the point is, God's servants are found in some of the most surprising and unlikely places. And if that's you, don't forget you have only one master. And he has placed you where you are for a purpose. Not necessarily to be the company evangelist, but you're there to serve him, not yourself. And others may not understand why you're there, or why you associate with this company or that employer. But God understands it. So do your job with integrity, with obedience to Christ, your true master, and trust him to accomplish his purpose through you. And he will. Let's pray.